this is Gilbert Gottfried. Welcome to Behind the Scenes with Brian, your go-to podcast on old things mining.
Welcome to Behind the Scenes with Brian, the podcast covering everything from engineering, mining, and mine waste management to whatever else may be on our minds. Pop in your headphones and don't forget to rate, subscribe, and share. And now, here is your host, Brian Ulrich.
Hi everyone, this is Brian. This is Behind the Scenes with Brian, and today I'm joined by Tim Fitton. Tim, how are you today?
Hello, Brian. I'm well, thank you, mate. And thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, absolutely. And where are you today?
I'm speaking to you from a beautiful little place called Sassafras, which is in Australia. It's about 40 kilometers east of Melbourne.
Sounds very nice. I've only been to the airport in Melbourne, so I don't really know what Melbourne is like, but describe Melbourne to us.
Melbourne's a beautiful city. It's about 4.5 million people, getting towards 5 million now.
Wow.
And it's the second largest city in Australia. It's beautiful and classy. It's quite reminiscent of a European city. So it's got a river flowing through it, and it's a very sprawled out city. The size of Melbourne is larger than the size of London, despite the fact that London has about three times more people. So Melbourne's a low density city. Most Melburnians live in the house with the backyard and the front yard.
Oh, nice.
But it's a beautiful city with a lovely climate. We don't get snow. It's a lovely place to be in a lovely country. So we're very fortunate here, maybe a little bit smug because we keep winning awards for having the most livable city in the world.
Well, and today it is hovering around about 0 degrees Fahrenheit, which is minus 18 Celsius here in Denver. So I'm a little bit jealous of your mild weather.
Yeah, it's 20 degrees Celsius here today.
And room temperature.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. So Tim, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, your education.
Yeah, so I'm born in Australia, which is a little bit rare these days because about a third of us are born outside or something like that. It's a huge percentage of our population are more recent arrivals. And that's one of the reasons why we've got such a wonderful country, because we are fortunate enough to get a lot of very clever people from overseas who want to live here.
Yeah.
And so I'm born here, and I studied civil engineering as a young school leaver, and I now work in the tailing space exclusively. I'm happy to go through the journey if you want, Brian.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, lead us there.
Yeah, okay. So I went to a university here in Melbourne and I studied civil engineering, and I then worked in the mining industry for the next 6 years. And I was doing construction of mining infrastructure, working at the mines for months at a time, even years at a time. And it was fun. It was like a permanent overseas type position in remote locations where the mines were being built.
Yeah.
I spent 2 years in Laos, for example,
and
9 months in Thailand. I was in Indonesia for many months, South America, Africa. So it was a remarkable opportunity for a young engineer to get amazing experience and immersion in languages. So I was very fortunate to get those opportunities. And I guess I took them with both hands and tried to enjoy them, and I did. But after 6 years of doing that, I was offered a scholarship to come back to Melbourne and undertake a PhD by research.
Okay.
And this was a bit of a career focusing point, you might say. The scholarship was sponsored by mining companies and a consulting firm, ATC Williams, an Australian tailings consulting firm.
Mm-hmm.
And they got joint funding for this research from a couple of mining companies. One was Anglo Gold Ashanti. And also, sorry, there was one mining company, and then there was also the Australian Research Council. Mm-hmm. So taxpayer money was thrown into the mix. And the PhD had a very specific focus. The project had already been defined, and it was to develop a method of predicting tailings beach slopes.
Mm-hmm.
So I went into this 3-year PhD course with that very specific goal. And I discovered that I was quite fortunate compared to most of the other PhD candidates that were around me at the university at the time, because they had far more broad topics. Some of them didn't even have a topic defined, mm-hmm. and they had mm-hmm. to come up with their own topic. And that proved to be very difficult for some of them to keep their PhD confined to the 3 years
because of the depth
of all of the research that they could get lost in. But thankfully, I had a very specific topic, and it enabled me to channel my focus into reading about all of the existing literature in that field, and then start picking that apart, especially any mathematical equations that related to open channel flow, fluid dynamics, hydraulics, rheology. And you might be thinking, well, what about all of the geotechnical type stuff, the soil mechanics, etc.? And indeed, when it comes to tailings beach slopes, you're dealing with the tailings slurry before it has actually stopped on a tailings deposit. And so in order for the beach slope to form, you really are interested in the fluid phase of that sequence rather than the soil phase afterwards. So I was able to grab these different pieces of theory and join them together mathematically to create a big ugly equation. And then I went out to a number of mines to carry out experimental research. And I was able to then gather up data and crunch the numbers in my equation to see if I was predicting beach slopes that coincided with the observations that we made on site.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, the equation worked. Obviously, I was lucky enough to be able to stand on the shoulders of the giants who actually published the right stuff.
Yeah.
So my job was certainly made easy by, well, easier by so many other contributions to the field in the last 200 years. So I went forth with my magical equation, and the sponsors were happy. And they said to me, when you finish your PhD, please talk to us before you talk to anyone else. And I was lucky enough to get a job there.
Yeah.
And I worked for ATC for the next 7.5 years. And it was good. I was able to apply the model from my PhD to many projects where I was predicting beach slopes, for mainly for thickened tailings type projects, where the beach slope has a much greater impact on the design and the economic outcomes. So that was, it was good work, and I enjoyed working there. And eventually I wished to to jump ship and spread my wings and steer my own ship. I resigned from ATC and set up my own business back in September of 2014, which I called Fit and Tailings Consultants. So for the last 9.5 years, I've been running as FTC, and it's been a wonderful opportunity to, I guess, control my own destiny, and I get to work in my own environment and have more flexible hours, because of course, once you are your own boss, your client, he might need a design by the end of March or whatever, and providing you deliver it by the deadline, they don't care if you've been working on it at strange hours, so long as it's done to a decent standard, they're happy. And so when you are your own boss, you can start, you know, being far more flexible in your attitude to your work, so long as you maintain availability to your clients and a focus on doing the work properly, you can have a much better work-life balance. And that's something that has really been a wonderful change for me compared to being a salaried employee. And over the past 25 years that I've been working in this arena, I've been very fortunate to work in more than 20 countries, and I've been able to travel to more than 70 as a tourist. And it's been a fabulous opportunity as an engineer and just as a citizen to get out and have that luxury. You know, I consider myself to be very, very fortunate and privileged for that. But I think to a large degree, the place where you come from is so relevant to that. And being from Australia, where, you know, school education is free to the public, travel is something, a luxury that we can readily afford due to our affluence as a nation. And as a child, you know, I wasn't particularly well healed compared to the others. You know, my mother was a nurse, my dad had a shop. We were not wealthy people, but I think we are very fortunate, and I can imagine the United States is similar, Brian, where these opportunities are there for those who recognize them and who wish to embrace them with enthusiasm. The sky's the limit.
You and I have kind of similar upbringings. My dad had a travel agency, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom, so we both had pretty modest beginnings. I would say very happy, but modest beginnings.
Yeah.
So Tim, what makes your beat slope prediction method successful where others aren't? And you don't have to mention names, but I know others have taken a rheological approach. But why? How did a two-part question, I guess. Why did the scholarship exist? Who wanted to know that answer? And what makes your model work where others have failed?
Good questions, Brian. So I'll start with the question about who would want to fund that sort of research. Who would want to use the outcomes of that research? I'll go back to the sponsors, who were ATC Williams. They were the prime sponsor and certainly the prime mover. Their founding director, Mr. Paul Williams, he had devoted many years of his own life to this very topic. And it dated right back to the very early 80s and possibly even late 70s when he was working in Bougainville, off New Guinea, part of New Guinea. He was on Bougainville Island at the Panguna mine, which was one of the world's largest, I think it's nickel mine, I think. Well, it could have been copper. But anyway, he was at Panguna and he was he had read about Eli Rabinsky's work. Eli had published by this stage, and Paul Williams was fascinated by that. And he sought to carry out his own experiments over there in Bougainville. And he did. He was a very inquisitive and hardworking bloke. And he set up experiments with beach slopes and different flow rates in a standalone sort of sub cell within a larger TSF.
And like a flume, though.
He was covering an area that was much greater than a tennis court.
Bigger
than a football field, actually.
Okay.
And he was burying this broad area in tailing slurry, but by being able to control the flow rate, he was able to start researching the impact on beach slopes can be affected by changing the flow rate, which, as it stands, it happens to be one of the major factors that impacts on beach slope flow rate. Mm-hmm. So he was looking at that stuff, and he worked on developing his own mathematical model, which he did do. He developed an equation. But then for the next few years, Paul developed a few more CTD-type designs, first at Illura in Australia and then Peak in Australia, and then a few others. He was involved with Sunrise Dam and Union Reefs, and there were about five or six, Century. All of these jobs, they were thick and discharge projects where the Rabinsky idea was applied. And thankfully for Paul, they all were quite successful. But unfortunately for Paul, he found that his equation wasn't nailing it every time. So he could see that there was the need for a more accurate equation. And so he was the prime mover. He had a consulting firm. At the time, he had 40 or 50 engineers working there. Oh. And they were designing these things and wishing they could predict this slope more accurately. So he talked to one of his clients at Sunrise Dam, and that client was AngloGold Ashanti. And they had this central thick and discharge stack that was running reasonably well. And Paul managed to convince them that if they could contribute to the funding for this research, it would deliver benefits for themselves as well as the broader mining industry. And kindly, they also agreed to contribute some funding. So now you had money coming from ATC and money coming from this crowd, AngloGold Ashanti. And together they talked to a number of universities, and they discovered that the Australian government was also prepared to financially contribute.
Oh, okay. Wow.
The Australian government could see that if you can convince them by presenting the business case about what the financial benefits might be to the industry, then the government sees, oh, yeah, there's a gain, a broader gain for the industry in general. So they also threw some money in. So that was the impetus in terms of who was after this magical equation. So they then banged on the door of quite a number of universities in Australia trying to find a university who would take up this research. And most of them didn't want to get involved, which surprises me a little bit now. Perhaps I shouldn't be so surprised. But in any event, they eventually found RMIT University in Melbourne. That's the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology was their old name. And then they changed their name to RMIT University once they got the formal accreditation as a university. They then took on the project, and somewhat oddly, it was taken up by the School of Chemical Engineering, not the civil engineers. My PhD was actually in chemical engineering, which is a bit odd because I'm not a chemist, and my chemistry skills are a bit average. But the reason was that the rheology lab at that university was under the watch of the School of Chemical Engineering. I went into that school and I carried out my three years of research. And in that time, I did use their rheology laboratory plenty of times. And we also did that field research that I referred to earlier. And by the end of the 3 years, I had my thesis written. I had some very good sets of validating data. Some of that data was collected at the mine sites. Some of that data was gathered in the laboratory at the university. Thankfully, the model that I developed applied quite well to both sets of data. So that gave it some very good basis for claiming its applicability to the mining industry. So that was the answer to your first part of your question. The more awkward answer that I now have to give you is, what about the other tailings beach model? Yeah. So I guess when you're an academic, you are supposed to present everything factually and as rigorously as you can, as academically as you can, where you don't concern yourself with politics or offending people. You simply look at the work that's being published by others and then you try to apply it yourself. So there were a number of beach slope models that were published before I did my PhD. Obviously, Gordon MacPhail had his method. And he had published quite a number of papers, but he wasn't the only person who had published in that field prior to my work.
Yeah,
there were others. John Waits had published something, a more empirical model. Mm-hmm. Fiona Sofra.
Yep.
RCS, I think they call themselves.
Hers was also based on rheology, right?
Yep, Fiona's was.
Yeah.
So Fiona worked under Professor David Boger, and she did a lot of very good work in the field of rheology, and indeed she still works in that field, focusing on rheology. But of those published models, I should also mention Gary Bentel, who also he was in South Africa under Jeff Blight, and he looked at this topic. So those guys who came before me, Gordon MacPhail was the only one who was roaming around with a model that he was publishing a lot about. But when I tried to apply that, I found it was very, very difficult to try and apply at the time of my PhD.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then after I published my PhD, by that time, Benham Pirouz had also published his own PhD, which was also a beach slope prediction. Mm-hmm. And Benham had also presented a model for predicting beach slopes. And at the time of my PhD, I tried to apply Benham's model and I found that I couldn't. And I approached ATC at the time, who were my sponsoring, you know, supervising authority. And I sat down with them and I said, look, this is the situation I'm in with Ben's model. Can you guys help me with that? Where am I going wrong? And at the time, I was with their technical manager, Keith Seddon, a very knowledgeable guy, very, very good tech engineer. And Keith and I spent some hours trying to apply the Pirouz model and we couldn't. So at the time, I just had to say, look, in its current state, I can't apply this. And that's what was written in the thesis. Since then, there were occasions where others stepped into this field and said, well, let's try and compare these models, particularly the MacPhail model and the Pirouz model and the Fitton model, and let's see how they go in a predictive experiment where we provide you with the input data, but we don't tell you what the beach slope is.
Yeah.
So it was a Professor Sims from Canada who was, he took up that role as the independent mediator. Yep. And indeed, at the time, Paul Sims had also published a model to predict beach slopes.
Hmm.
And his model was also featuring rheology. So we carried out the work, and it was a challenging paper to write because of the involvement from a number of people. Richard Jewell, the late Richard Jewell, was involved. And Andy Furey, a professor at UWA, was also involved in trying to get this paper written. There was a lot of work put in by Gordon MacPhail and myself and Paul Sims. And after the predictions were made, I had then been provided by MacPhail with a spreadsheet that he used for calculating rheology.
Mm.
Once I had that, I was then able to apply his model. And a year later, I presented another paper in 2014 that showed MacPhail's predictions for a number of other scenarios. And he was livid because the predictions that I obtained were not good.
Mm.
He was very upset, and he had accused me of doing it wrong and all this sort of thing.
Mm.
But I don't believe that was the case. I think I was acting with academic rigor and honesty.
Yeah.
So the answer to your question is quite an awkward one now, because of course I'm no longer an academic. I'm an engineer who's consulting like himself, as is MacPhail, Gordon MacPhail, as is Ben, and Paul Sims being a professor. Well, those guys seem to jump the fence a little bit between being consultants and being academics, where the situation arises. So to cast such comments nowadays is a little more awkward, because you could be easily offending people and stepping on their toes. But I would suggest in more recent years, Benham Pirouz has released another paper where he basically produced a new beach slope model that was very similar to my own. His previous model was based on so-called settlement tests. You put a set of samples in a cylinder, and the interface gradually settle over a period of hours. And his model was looking at the speed of the separation of these solid particles in a fluid. And at the time, I was of the opinion that that's not relevant.
It's not logical to me either, because that's unhindered sedimentation.
Ben may have had other bases for justifying it.
Yeah.
And I think it's fair to say I should let Ben discuss that himself.
And I would say it's not outlandish to have that in the equation.
Well, he had that, and that was a key input parameter to his model. Mm-hmm. Mine, on the other hand, my model was not based on any sort of settlement test. My model was based on, to try and put it very basically, it was based on working out the minimum transport velocity, which is it's an equation that's commonly kicked around by the pipeline designers. Indeed, there are dozens of minimum transport velocity equations, some of which date back to the 1950s.
Mm.
Ed Wasp was working at Bechtel, but there are, he published one of the first models, and there have been others since then who have published other models that are arguably more accurate than his. So I took one of those minimum transport velocity equations basically added some rheological parameters and equated that to what would be the average velocity based on a volumetric flow rate through a set cross section. And it's a very crude approach, but it worked. So that was the model I built, which I think was pretty rough and ready, but it seemed to work.
Yeah.
And now Benham's model is basically the same type of thing where you're equating those two basic tenets and you end up with a number.
Mm-hmm.
So there are those two models, which I think work. And I know that because mine was published in the public arena, my model was published and others have been able to download it and apply it.
Yeah.
I believe that a lot of consulting firms around the world are now using my published model. And I would dare say that perhaps people are also using Benham's as well, because in the most recent paper that he presented on that, I believe his model was also one that could be applied.
Okay.
McPhail's model, I don't believe anyone is able to apply other than Gordon McPhail. And I think that's quite deliberate on his part, that it forces his clients to have to talk to him and it prevents them from ringing up one of the other big tailors.
When I was looking at his approach, it seemed to me like he had more unknowns than equations. But I have had a similar experience with a guy with his pressure meter where he was doing some curve fitting to the data, and he could do this thing perfectly every single time, and he gave me a software and I could never match it. So there was a lot of parts as well as understanding and his ability to match the curves, and I think that must be this similar to what Gordon McPhail does with his approach.
Yeah. What was the name of the other guy with the curve fitting?
John Hughes.
John Hughes.
Yeah. So he took a thing. He went to Cambridge. He took a thing that used to be called the Camcometer, the Cambridge K-naught meter. And he developed it into a self-boring pressure meter that could be used in tailings. So it's the pressure meter is kind of like an inside out triaxial test. So instead of compressing a vertical cylinder, you're expanding vertically outward in a cylinder. So it's kind of the same mechanics, only inside out. So I loved having that experience with John Hughes, and I got to spend quite a bit of time with him. He's fantastic person and a brilliant guy as well.
Wow. Well, I hadn't heard of him, which is a little surprising if he's published anything that pertains to Tarns beach slopes.
Not beach slopes, but tailings. Yeah, he's a Cambridge PhD, and he was a pretty quiet individual. So he had an in situ testing company that was in British Columbia. So he built CPT devices. He built his own instead of buying them off the shelf, and he had his own pressure meter and field vane shear tests, and just a brilliant guy, and it's just a joy to learn from.
It sounds like he's quite an inventive fellow, which I admire.
Very kind of a mad scientist in a way.
Cool. I should get together. I've done some crazy things myself, but with respect to John Hughes and his curve fitting.
Yeah.
This can be dated back to Gary Bentel, but when he was doing his PhD at Witwatersrand, where Gordon McPhail did his.
Yeah.
So McPhail and Bentel were both working under Jeff Blight. And my understanding was that Gary Bentel came up with a model where essentially it gave you a curve fitting equation, and if you could tell it what the length of the beach was and the initial slope, it could give you a profile. So he came up with this mathematical equation that gave you a beach profile, but in order to get the answer you had to tell it what the slope was and what the length was. So it wasn't particularly useful in a predictive capacity, but it was useful in giving you a curve that was realistic compared to what would happen in real life, but obviously you needed to know those inputs. Gordon came along And with his energy and entropy type focus, he claimed to have a model that could predict the slope. And I looked at his early published papers, and all of them were curve fitting exercises where he looked at an existing beach and he put in the slopes and the lengths and things, and he came up with what he called a predicted profile, which was actually a fitted, or it was a curve fit. And I thought it was very misleading and a little bit unethical to refer to that as a predicted profile. Because the prediction was requiring the answer. So I took exception to it, and I do recall having conversations with Gordon about that, where I said to him, look, you should be referring to these as fitted profiles, not predicted ones. Yeah. And sure enough, in subsequent papers, I think he did start referring to those profiles as fitted profiles, but he was still presenting such profiles to show how accurately his model was predicting beach profiles. And I just thought that's so misleading and in a way dishonest, because it was, you were not predicting anything. You were simply taking an existing beach profile and then putting the parameters into your model, and sure enough, here it is. It matches. Mm-hmm. So that sort of thing was happening. And where Gary Bentel wasn't referring to his as a predicted beach slope, Gordon was using those three words, prediction, beach, and slope. And obviously nowadays when you type in beach slope prediction into a search engine, you'll get Gordon MacPhail's papers. And I think I've said enough there, other than the fact that that was the way some of these workers were focusing on this so-called profile rather than the actual slope. Mm-hmm. So there was also another field with other workers who were doing flume tests.
Yeah.
And the definition of a flume is very loose. So some people have a fish tank, which is closed on five sides, you know, with an open top.
Yeah.
And they pour stuff in at one end, and then they look at the shape that forms in there. Their fish tank might be a meter long or even a half meter long, and they come up with a shape, and they measure it, and they say, well, this is what we're going to get. And of course, it's vastly wrong, because those types of tests failed to appreciate the impact that the flow rate has. And that was one of the key points that I tried to hammer home 10 years ago when I was at various PACE conferences and the like, trying to suggest to people that you can't do a test in a fish tank that's going to be relevant. You need the flow rate to be scalable, or you need to appreciate the impact of the flow rate. So
I remember reading the dissertation by Angela Cooper.
Yes.
And hers was on the flume test, and she concluded that a flume is just a flume.
I kind of
took the world a little bit longer to agree to that, but I think everybody understands now that a flume is just a flume. It's not a model of the beach.
Well, this is where I will be more contrary, Brian. You have to excuse me, but there is the fish tank flume, the closed box where you discharge the slurry.
Yeah.
But then there is the open-ended flume where you have a slurry pouring in one end, and it runs down this thing and pours out the other end. And if you can tilt that flume, then you can flatten the slope until such time as the particles start to deposit in the base of that open-channel flume. And at that point, you can start making deductions about what's happening on a real tailings beach. And that was the method that I used when I was doing my PhD, when I went to the mine sites in Western Australia and New South Wales, and we set up a flume that was 10 meters long.
Okay.
And essentially we had live feed from a pipeline coming into that flume at the upstream end. And there was a, we were able to adjust the grade of the flume by having a pivot at the upstream end,
yeah,
and a winch with a chain block at the other end. So we were able to hoist the low end up or down and change the angle. So we basically started discharging a slurry into this thing, and then we would leave it running for 10 minutes and then check to see if there's any particles in the bottom.
Yeah.
And I was doing that very, very basically by just diving my hand in there and feeling around to see if there's any particles settling on the base.
Yeah.
And then after a half hour, I thought, well, there's nothing happening. Let's crank up the angle a bit and shallow it off. And so I would then give it some time and feel around. And eventually you'd get to a point where particles start to deposit.
Yeah.
And so I would take note of that flow rate, that concentration, and that angle.
Mm.
And that was a data point to plot.
Okay. Okay.
And I did the same test many times, but I would change the flow rate each time, or I would change the concentration.
Yeah.
And by changing those two parameters, I came up with a whole scattered cloud of data. And I was then able to start using that as validating data for my model.
Mm, okay.
Unfortunately, okay. That data was spot on. And that was the sort of core assumption at the heart of my model, that there's this concept of an equilibrium slope where
you've
got the process of erosion is in equilibrium with the process of deposition, as in
right. Yep.
So if you can make that slope just perfectly somewhere in between those two extremes,
mm-hmm.
it's not so flat that you get deposition, it's not so steep that you get erosion, then you're at that magical midpoint, which is what I was arguing was the applicable slope on a tailings beach.
Yeah, okay.
And it was by that argument that we came up with this model. And then I developed my equation around that assumption that we got to have a velocity that's just high enough to keep all these particles in motion and stop them. And that's why the pipeline engineer's minimum transport velocity equations were so applicable. Mm. They had already done half of the hard work.
Yeah.
Instead of setting up a flume with a tilting angle, the pipeline guys had a pipe that was horizontal.
Yep.
And they would change the pump speed, and they would say, mm-hmm. all right, we've got slurry that's 50% solids or whatever, and they would pump through this thing, and if there were deposition occurring, they would have a clear view window or something in the pipe. And so they were able to see the bottom of the pipe, and if stuff was depositing on the pipe, they would say, oh, we're below the deposition velocity, let's accelerate, we'll turn up the pump. And they determined these minimum transport velocities, which were very, very applicable to what I was trying to do.
Right.
So I'm grateful to all those guys, because thanks to their work, I was able to grab their equation and basically smash it in with all this other stuff, and it worked. And I was like, wow, this is really cool. So I guess I'm grateful to the decades of pipeline engineers who got the ball rolling for me.
Yeah. Okay. Very cool.
Hmm. So, was there any other aspect to your question that I forgot to answer there, Brian?
No, I think you covered it. I think you covered it really well.
Well, hopefully I don't get too many bullet holes in my pattern.
So, Tim, how often do you use that in your business now?
I guess whenever there's a project that is looking at beach slopes. So obviously Eli Rabinsky was talking about central thickened discharge, where you're making a circular cone on a flat surface. And Eli also spoke about a downhill discharge scenario where you had a valley and you discharge from the top and you have the dam at the bottom and you get a beach that's sloping toward the dam. So those are two main scenarios where I would want to apply my model. But even sometimes people want to know about the shape of the beach in a conventional cell, where you've got an embankment, say, in a square shape, at all at one elevation, and you're discharging from the embankment. they might want to know, well, how low is the middle of the beach going to be compared to the edges? So you'd be surprised how often I get asked to apply this model. I've also been involved with, there was an interesting job I did in Mexico where they were discharging slurry down a natural valley, a river valley, and they were wanting to recover more water. And so they were talking to a thickener supplier about the installation of more thickeners. But the concern that the client had was, is this stuff still going to run down our valley, or is it going to start stacking up and it'll never get to the destination that we reach? So I was called in and I went over there to Mexico and did some rheology testing of their slurry. And I applied the beach slope model, not for a beach, but actually for this river valley. And it was useful in that regard too. So when you're dealing with open channel flows of tailing slurries, the beach slope model is directly applicable. So if you're designing a flume that might be 10 miles long for transporting tailing slurry from the processing plant to the TSF, the beach slope model is useful there as well. So I've been involved with a few of those types of projects as well.
Mm, interesting. Yeah. You definitely don't want your flumes to get clogged up. So that's an interesting application.
Well, once they do, well, it's only a matter of time before the particles start building up in the bottom of the flume, and eventually the slurry flows over the side walls and you start filling up the landscape somewhere halfway.
Yeah, good stuff, Tim. Good stuff. So, Tim, what do you find yourself doing most often for your work these days? What kind of fields do you work on, and what kind of clients do you have? What keeps you busy?
Look, I've got a range of clients. Coal mining companies in Australia are a pretty big business in terms of mining industry revenues. The coal mining businesses in Australia are doing a lot of work. We have a lot of coal mines, and those mines are generally quite large. So I do a lot of work with those guys. I also have clients in other industries. You know, Ranger up in the Northern Territory, they are mining uranium. They've been a client for many years. And then there's a whole lot of randoms that pop up and down, gold mining companies and copper mining companies and things, some of which are overseas. So I still work for various clients overseas and in Australia. And in terms of the type of work, there's a bit of this type of beach slope type stuff where I might be invited to carry out a design of a stack or a design of a down valley discharge, the design of a flume. Those are jobs that I've done for a few clients. I also do the more regulatory type stuff where I have to apply more of the civil engineering type approach and the to dam design and geotechnical type stuff to do with ownership of dams and the annual reporting and annual inspections and that sort of thing. I do a fair bit of that. And also capping of tailings dams. So the coal mining industry that I spoke of, those guys in Australia, the coal seams that we mine are often very rich in very fine clays. And so after you mine the coal and process it and wash it, the tailings is often very rich in clays, which gives you a very fine tailings that doesn't want to settle. And so they store it in pit in most of our coal mines in the east coast of Australia. Most of their TSFs are in pit tailings dams, and the material that goes in there doesn't settle. And 10 years after it's been discharged and deposited, you can go back there and it's still incompetent for a person to walk upon it. The tailings won't support a human. And so obviously if you wish to cap that deposit, you can't get a machine out there either. So I do a lot of work in that field. which is more geotechnical than rheological. But remarkably, some of these situations are still so fluid that indeed it is a rheological problem in some cases, where you can start pushing dirt out onto the tailings facility and that dirt sinks. And the material that fails underneath it, instead of forming the classic slip circle failure that you would expect with the bow wave, etc., you can actually encounter situations where the fill material sinks and the tailings underneath flows laterally, and the, mm-hmm. the rest of the TSF swells up. Mm-hmm. So you get mm-hmm. heave, but instead of it being in the bow wave area from a slip circle failure, you get this more generalized hydraulic effect. You're applying load here and you get a movement over here. And this loaded area might have a small surface area. It might sink by, say, a meter or 2 meters. And this area here might have a huge surface area of many hectares. So it rises by a matter of a few millimeters in response. And they keep loading up this area, and this other bigger area just keeps creeping upwards and upwards. And they...
Yeah, if you equate it to a bearing capacity problem, it's more of a punching failure than a traditional bearing capacity slip failure.
Yeah, and what's happening at depth when you do CPT testing or shear vane testing?
Yeah.
You dig down. I've gone out there with an auger, like a post hole digger.
Yeah.
And start digging away, and you get down through a half a meter of crust, and the material underneath is fluid, and it will start oozing up through the hole in the crust. And you can have it start flowing forth like a very slow motion lava flow. And you come back the next day and it's still flowing, and it's now covered a quarter of an acre. You come back a week later and it's now covered an acre. And this stuff is oozing like some sort of weird treacle. So the tailings is still very fluid in some of these TSFs. Yeah. And you look at it as a geotechnical problem when you're designing the capping, but in reality, some of them are actually behaving more like a fluid.
Interesting.
It's fascinating because I guess I'm in that weird situation where I'm straddling fluid mechanics with one foot and geotechnics in the other, and there's this curious world where the two merge and they meet. And one of those is obviously when we deposit the slurry on a tailings beach, because it's a liquid and then the particles settle out and then you've got a soil. But there are these other rare scenarios like the capping situation where the fine material, the fine particles in that tailings are so fine, they just don't settle. And it's almost like a suspension where there's virtually no bleed water and this stuff just sits there for years and years. And I've seen it in mineral sands, I've seen it in the uranium tailings, where you can have some bleed, water will bleed out after deposition, and then the rest of the material will sit there for many, many years, and it won't condense anymore. You have to do things like wicking and other methods to try and densify it. It's a fascinating field.
Well, Tim, I've been on my own for about 4 years now, and I don't have any regrets about being on my own, but I do have some things that I miss about working in a company. And one of them is not just the camaraderie, hanging around the coffee machine or whatever and chatting with your friends about the game last night, but
about
being able to walk down the hall and talk to one of your colleagues about a difficult problem that you're trying to solve. I kind of miss that. And not that I don't have any context that I can do, but it's different than just walking down the hall and go three doors down and working something out. Do you have any similar experiences in your job? Something like that you could share with us?
Yeah, I'll be happy to. I agree with you completely that when you do jump ship and start up your own business, there's definitely a very significant change in that atmosphere of your workplace. But one thing that we need to, well, I suppose there's two points. One is that thankfully, when I left my ex-employer, one of my other colleagues, he left the business virtually at the same time.
Okay.
And so he often works, well, he generally always works with me as a contractor to my business.
Oh, okay. So
and he's a guy, an engineer of your own age, and he's very well experienced and knowledgeable. So he's somebody I can always phone up and discuss other issues. For example, he did a master's degree in consolidation behavior of tailings.
Oh, okay, okay.
And he's one of the world's experts. Stephen Murphy is his name. Hmm. So he's published in the field. And when I have questions about that sort of thing, I can phone him up.
Yeah, but wonderful.
As a geotechnical engineer, Steve is also very knowledgeable in the usual breadth of issues that we encounter as tailings engineers.
Mm-hmm.
So if I ever find that I want a second pair of eyes, or even Steve, what's this? He can explain it to me quite well 9 out of 10 times, because it's usually something he has seen before.
Okay.
So
okay.
There are people like Steve that I've had the luxury of being able to chat with, but that doesn't address the other issue that you speak of in terms of camaraderie and the social aspect. Being able to just ask your mate, oh, how was your weekend type talk? And that has been quite a change as well. And I dare say that for all of those other people who are employed in the more conventional sense, they are possibly sitting at home like me and you because of COVID. Even though the COVID lockdowns are now over in most parts of the world, including Australia, a lot of those people got a taste for working from home, mm-hmm. and they decided we are still productive. We're still producing as much as we did before COVID. So do we really need to return to the office? Some of them have chosen to go back because they miss the social interaction. Some of them have gone back to work because the boss has said you are now required to come back to work. But a lot of them have continued to work from home. Maybe not full time. Some of them, 4 days a week, they might stay at home. And then on one day of the week, they go to the office for the meetings. But I have friends who have continued to work from home 5 days a week. Mm. And they only ever go into the office at the occasions where it's absolutely necessary. Or otherwise, they're happy to stay at home and work in the same capacity that you and I do. And yet, they are still employees rather than running their own show. So in terms of that social mix, I must admit, my partner, she works from home as well. And the two of us, we generally go out every day and get lunch together. Mm. And we walk into the village. It's a beautiful walk through the forest.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very pretty. And the village is charming and quaint up here in Sassafras. So we have a lovely work-life balance. And in terms of social life and all that stuff, certainly I've got other mates that I can go see after work or weekends. And so having people in the workplace that I associate with, I do miss that, but I guess I've discovered that you can still have a good social life without necessarily having to socialize with the guy in the cubicle next to you.
Well, it's interesting. COVID taught us a lot of things. And pre-pandemic, I think there was a lot of hesitancy to allow people to work from home, which is kind of funny because it's like, if you don't trust this guy, you should get rid of him. If you think he's robbing from the company, he's going to rob from the company no matter where he is. And post-pandemic, all of a sudden, we can see the value in remote working company I used to work for now has an office accommodation that's much smaller than they had pre-pandemic. And it's because they let people work from home, and they have this thing, hoteling or motelling, I can't remember which one it is, but you go into work and you don't know where your desk is, so you have to ask the receptionist where you're working from today. So they don't have enough desks for all the people that they have on purpose. You know, they save a lot of money on rent, and they either trust the people that they have working remotely, or they figure out this guy's just not fun. And maybe they give a guy a second chance if he doesn't work remotely well. Bring him into the office, have him a full-time office worker. But, you know, following the pandemic, I think so many people got a taste of working from home. And like you and me, I don't work all day every day, but I tend to work every day. I work Monday through Sunday, but not necessarily all day. You know, I get to pick and choose. I go for a run when I want to go for a run. I go to the gym when I go to the gym. But I get my work done for my clients on time with the product that they expect from somebody that's a professional. So I think part of that is because of learnings from the pandemic, and part of it is just doing the right thing.
That's right. And I think with respect to the employees who might have once upon a time been more inclined to take the advantage of their boss, if the boss said, yes, you can work from home, and then they go home and they do something that's not work. Those people, I think COVID changed their attitudes too, because you could sit at home and watch telly for a little while, but the problem was the boss might eventually say, well, where's that thing that you were supposed to have finished by Friday?
Right.
And eventually, even those people who might have been prepared to take the mickey a little bit, those guys eventually realized, oh, they're expecting me to perform. And I think the working from home thing, I believe there are very few people who actually take the mickey. Most of them are actually quite diligent now.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that's been a pretty big eye-opener for the industry, not just the engineering industry, but the global sort of office place type industry. Accountants and lawyers and everybody, they're all realizing they can work from home on a computer. And indeed, they could be sitting on a beach somewhere with their cell phone, and if they get something they need to look at, they could go back to their hotel and open the laptop and work on that for a few hours. I think people can now live a much better life thanks to that change in attitudes. And they can be, you know, you could be sitting on a beach in France right now, Brian, and you know, you got a thing you got to do. Well, you can set up your laptop in a bar or at your hotel room, and then, you know, you could do the job. So I think we're entering a new era where attitudes that had prevailed for hundreds of years since the Industrial Revolution, where an employee was regarded as the property of the employer.
Yeah.
You know, we own you from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. That's where you need to be or else.
Mm-hmm.
That's changed now. And I think, thankfully, it's due to the fact that our work habits have changed so much that a significant percentage of employees nowadays are seated in front of a desk with a computer in front of them, which is an activity that never existed back in the early days of the Industrial Revolution. But it's taken, even in the last 10 or 20 years when everybody has had computers, it's taken COVID to finally drop the penny for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And they now realize, oh, this is something we could have been doing for the last 20 years. Why didn't we think of it before?
Yeah, very, very, very true. It's unfortunate that the pandemic teaches these lessons, but I think they're very important lessons, and I think we came out of it much better than when we went into it. And like you say, you know, if you've got a young family and your kid has a Christmas pageant at 2 p.m, unless you have something, meetings or deadlines that are interfering with it, you can go see your kid's Christmas pageant at 2 p.m.
Yeah, that's right. It's great.
I mean, just get your job done and work the hours you're supposed to work, even if it's at a different hour of the day than your 9 to 5.
And maybe this understanding of workplace dynamics is going to be something that changes many careers in the next 5 to 10 years, Brian. I look at, say, you and me, engineers. We are in a profession that lends itself beautifully to working from home.
Yeah.
And we look at other people like a shop attendant or a nurse in a hospital or even a police officer.
Yeah.
Those guys can't do this. And I do believe that in the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to find a lot more kids are going to realize, hey, my dad, he's an accountant, and we get to go to the beach on a Tuesday afternoon or we go skiing, you know. And the other kid whose dad is a cop or something, he doesn't get that luxury. And I think in years to come, professions like our own and accountants and other office workers, their desirability are going to go up further because of that freedom that the working from home.
Yeah, good point. Very good point.
Yeah.
Tim, we've talked about a lot of stuff today. Is there anything that you wanted to talk about that we hadn't already discussed?
Look, there's nothing more that I wanted to discuss in terms of engineering, but to anyone who's managed to listen this far, I say, well done. You've done a better effort. But if there's a take-home message that I would give to anybody, it's it was a thing I saw the other day on television on a show called Ted Lasso, which you might get over here. And he misquoted an American, I think, and he said, "Be curious, not judgmental." It's a wonderful quote. So even if it was a misquote, that doesn't matter. The benefit of that comment is so rich. And I would say to anyone who's out there and listening to this stuff, be curious about what's around you. Be curious about what others might have to say. Don't judge. Don't be closed-minded to anything, because there is so much out there, so much richness to embrace. And if you're curious, your life will be a lot richer.
Well, I agree with that. And I think in general, engineers ought to be curious and not just accept this convention as being the one and only way. You need to be curious and turn over a few rocks and see if it's really the way it is, or if there's something different going on. So I think that's really good advice. Tim, I really appreciate your time with us today and your insights that you've shared. And until we meet next time, thanks so much for being with us, and I look forward to our next encounter.
As do I, Brian, and thank you for your time. Enjoy the cold up there in America.
Well, it'll warm up. That's the only thing I can look forward to, is the warm up. The cold is unavoidable, but the warm up will be here.
All right, thanks, Brian. Well, nice chatting with you, mate. You take care.
You too. Thanks again, Tim.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Well, that's it. I'm Brian, and this is Behind the Scenes with Brian. Until next time, keep on rockin'.